Hello, everyone, again. I'm still Michael Waldman. The last two panels, we hope, will provide insight, but will also provide some translation services, translation of some of the things that people have been saying, things that people have been talking about, problems people have identified, and solutions we've begun to point toward, translate them a little bit into how they could actually possibly happen. What will happen when these excellent ideas move into or collide with the world of politics, of policymaking, of organizing, and of philanthropy? So in this panel, we're going to talk about political strategies. And in the next panel, some of the funders and philanthropists who are here will talk about what they've heard and how they see their own funding strategies going forward. And we are really, really fortunate to have, I think, the folks on this panel here to give us their insight. You have folks who've worked in the real world of organizing, in government, in politics. You have, it should be tremendously exciting. So let me introduce the panelists in order. And give a sense of what we hope to ask. First, we're going to hear from David Frum. David, of great interest to me, among other things, is a very well-known alum of presidential speechwriting, where he was a speechwriter, senior speechwriter for President George W. Bush. He writes for the Daily Beast, is the author of numerous books about the conservative movement, about the 1970s, and most notably and recently, the book Why Romney Lost. We will then hear from Elaine Kmark. Elaine, as you know, is at the Kennedy School, a senior fellow at Brookings, one of the movers in the Reformation movement, in a sense, as it saw itself, of the Democratic Party in the 1980s. Through the DLC, the director of the Reinventing Government Initiative for Vice President Al Gore, and most recently, and again of relevance, the author of the book, How Change Happens or Doesn't, The Politics of U.S. Public Policy. She'll be followed by Trey Grayson. Trey has been engaged in this work in the trenches as an elected official, as a candidate for office, as a party activist. He was the Secretary of State of Kentucky, well-regarded nationally, a leading Republican Party figure in the state, was a candidate for U.S. Senate in Kentucky, and is now the director of the Institute of Politics at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. And we're grateful to have Trey here, and he is also known by many of you as a real expert and a leading thinker on the issues of election administration and election reform and voter registration reforms, too. Richard Kirsch is unable to be with us, and he has an even happier reason than the snow, which is he has a new grandchild born yesterday. Nice. So we're not going to be able to hear from him. But we will be able to hear from Deepak Bhargava, finally. Deepak is known to many, many of you. He is the executive director of the Center for Community Change, one of the country's leading organizations dealing with issues of poverty and representing and organizing poor communities and communities of color, and has, among other things and of significant relevance, been deeply involved in the cross-ideological and cross-partisan work of pushing for immigration reform. And I hope he'll share some of his insights for us on that. The real question here is how. Not only how does political change happen and how do good ideas become reality, but how does political change happen when that political change is about political change? How does one engage the public or organize the public on issues of democracy and a workable government and democracy reform? We all know these are frequently, intrinsically arcane issues. They're sometimes technical. We sometimes frame them in technical ways. No one ever marched for election administration, although perhaps they marched for other things such as democracy. But the fact is, there have been times, many times in the country's history, where these very kinds of issues that we've spent the last day and a half talking about have engaged the public deeply, have engaged policymakers deeply, have been the stuff people sit around and talk about at their proverbial kitchen table, and have led to bursts of when there have been dislocations, when there have been other times when the government seems out of sync with the reality of the time or unable to act, where there's often been a surprising burst of progress. And the progressive era was one of those, but not the only one. Or is this an unnecessary mission? Do we not actually need a broad public mobilization to get necessary reforms? That's a possibility too. How do we, in looking at these issues, grapple with partisan realities? The very polarized nature of the system we've just heard about makes it harder to get people talking about changes that aren't necessarily for one party or another, but for the whole health of the government or the democracy. How do we, those of us who are running organizations or journalists or academics or funders, how do we grapple with what we've occasionally heard as the asymmetrical nature of where things stand right now in terms of difficulties within the two parties? Is that itself a temporary blip and not something that should concern people? These are all the issues that will be dealt with in the real world. We're very lucky to hear from these folks. So let's start, David, if we could. What does one need to do to get real change?
Thank you, Michael. Michael did not mention our most important connection, that we were parents in elementary school together.
That's no, very true.
Pre-K. Our sons were in the same pre-K class. I am going to take a moment of vanity just to say, put a footnote to my book about why, that you kindly mentioned, Why Romney Lost. The most important thing about that book was not anything it said, but the date it was published, November 8th of 2012. And I promise you I didn't write it in 12 hours. Because I think one of the things that happens when you analyze is you need to be held to account whether your last round of analysis was correct, and I'm going to claim some correctness on that. As you think about how political change can happen, one of the barriers to change that I'd like to identify is a barrier that inhabits the assumptions and mentalities of many people of goodwill who lead the cause of reform, so-called, because I think there has been a tendency, for all the many disagreements Americans have, over the past 80 years, there's been broad agreement on what constitutes reform. And large elements of this agenda have been implemented, and after each implementation, things get worse. And then we do more of them, and then they get worse again. There's a broad consensus that the way to make American politics better is to break the hold of the parties over individual ambitious candidates. Now, I understand you addressed that the argument, this may not turn out to be such a great idea, but there's certainly broad consensus that more transparency is absolutely needed in government. Secrecy is bad, confidentiality is bad, especially in the executive branch, and things, there must be more sunlight. So if the executive wants to meet with anybody advocating a policy, the executive should publish all of the people they're meeting with, and do so not do so once a quarter, but do so instantly in real time on the internet. And that way, you can ensure that all executive meetings always happen in coffee shops where there's no security. or else you can ensure that any meeting that anybody in an executive branch has must be followed by five more completely useless meetings from people to whom there's no intention to pay any attention, but who now must be gratified because they know that you're meeting with somebody who disagrees with them. There's broad consensus that that the way change comes, and Michael said this, and there's certainly some broad movements in American life of which this is true, is through popular participation rather than through elite consensus. In fact, the very word elite is always used in a disobliging way. Even as American society becomes as wealth and power become more concentrated at the top, the idea that that is where change is going to happen becomes ever more anathema. I would like to propose that when you think about what you're trying to do, that you avoid a mistake that is very common in political movements, to make shibboleths of particular policies. There is no error in politics more deadly, said the great Marquess of Salisbury, than sticking to the carcasses of dead policies. You need to think, what are the indicators of American dysfunction, and how can each of them be overcome? And I point to four things that in our recent time are the indications of a state system not working. The first is Can the state fight and win wars? That is the single, in my opinion, I think through history, fighting and winning wars is the single most important job a state has. America has fought a lot of wars since 1945, but the record of success is not so good. If you can't win wars, your state is in trouble. The second is, can the state consistently balance its books over time? If your state cannot bring, balancing its books, I don't mean to be a deficit fetishist. I certainly am not one of those who thinks that the deficit right now is the country's most important problem, or even in one of its top three. But what persistent deficits show is a political system that cannot bring its ends and means into harmony with each other. And that is a sign of political failure, whatever its economic effects. If you persistently can't do that, there's a lack of realism and coordination in the system. Can the state get value for money? States spend money. One of the things that is remarkable about the American state compared to any other is that it's the United States is not significantly, if you look at all of its levels of state spending, federal, state, and local and regional, and if you include tax expenditures as well as direct expenditures, it's not significantly less expensive than the states of Europe. But the results are always much worse. And there is something about the American state that is unable to get value for money. And the last is the ability to manage the economy successfully over time and respond to crisis effectively. This is a new role for government. It's one they've only taken on since World War II. It's one that the United States has had some success with until about 1980, and since then seems to be less and less effective at. When you look at those areas, if those are the things you're trying to make better, then you have to question, does your reform project address each of those? Transparency is obviously not a great aid in fighting and winning wars. It's a great detriment to fighting and winning wars. The weakening of the political parties is one of the reasons that the United States has so much trouble getting value for money, because there are more and more people who carry vetoes. There are fewer and fewer people with the power to say yes. Places where accountability can be held multiply, and the more places there are, there are more competing actors there are seeking to take over the accountability function of government, the more impossible it is for that accountability actually to take place. I know we are, these opening remarks are to be very brief, so I will curtail what I want to say, but my advice in moments of government failure is to revert to the American figure who thought most profoundly about how to make Republican government succeed, and in my opinion, that is Alexander Hamilton, and to go back to the teachings and ideas that he had about the importance of empowering leadership, both within Congress and within the executive, understanding that day in, day out, the executive is going to be the predominant branch of government, that it must be able to lead and administer effectively. The executives that want to function need the ability to function with some internal confidentiality, that accountability should happen at elections, but not minute by minute in between, that it is just as bad to be monitoring the health of a government every second in polls as it is to monitor the health of a company by following its minute by minute stock performance. And that those who call themselves reformers need to ask themselves, are they carrying around ideas that are relevant to the problems of today, or are we sticking to the carcasses of old policies intended to solve and redress old, exploded, and abandoned problems? Thank you.
Thank you, David. Thank you for really thoughtful ideas. Elaine?
Sure. I'd like to talk a little bit about change itself, change in the American political system. And I started thinking about this because I started thinking about Harry Truman in 1946, who was perhaps one of the most unpopular presidents we've ever had. In fact, not only was he not invited to campaign for Democrats in the 46 midterms, not only did he lose the Congress in 46, but when he came home to Washington after the midterm break, in those days the tradition was that the cabinet would all go to Union Station and meet the president and welcome him back home. Well, no one came. So there you go. I mean, he was an incredibly unpopular at that point in time. And a year later, with this recalcitrant, angry Congress, he passed the Marshall Plan. Now, the Marshall Plan put a ton of American money in Europe at a point when American men mostly were coming home from the war and there were lots of needs in the States. And you have to step back and say, what happened? How could that happen, right? Why could that happen? And so I then tortured a generation of Kennedy School students with this problem of how change can happen, and came up with a kind of rough matrix, not very sophisticated, but a matrix which I'll briefly review, to talk about how we should think about change. We have lots of sophisticated models for policy analysis, right? But this is for the political analysis of a policy problem. First of all, is to look at the problem itself. How long standing is it? How many decades have people been worrying the problem? Has it made the transition from private to public? Smoking took a long time to make that transition from the private realm to the public realm. Mayor Bloomberg wants to do that for sodas, and he's meeting a fair amount of resistance. So just understanding the nature of the problem that you're dealing with. The second one I'd look at is the solutions proposed themselves, right? What are the solutions proposed? Are the solutions based on American values? One of the geniuses of Franklin Roosevelt's Social Security plan was that he made it an insurance plan. He did not take the models of Isaac Rubinoff and the Europeans who were trying to urge on him a European social welfare model. He made a uniquely American model. And of course, his famous quote is often quoted about this, which is, "No goddamn politician is ever going to take Social Security away." And it was because of the way he designed it. He designed it with a sense of American values. Is there certainty in the solution? I mean, yeah, of course we have a lot of problems getting climate change legislation passed. But guess what? Nobody could ever tell you with any degree of certainty when cap and trade was on the floor of the Senate, they could not tell you what your electricity bill was going to be. They couldn't tell you. Why? Because they had a market system out there. They were creating a market system. Who knew what was going to happen with the market system? And so a fundamental political goal, being able to say to people, this is what you will pay, they could not answer. So a lot of times, things we blame on polarization, sometimes we don't have a really good answer. We don't have a really good solution. I divide the players in the political world into inside and outside players, inside players being the formal, you know, Congress, president, et cetera. And here, the biggest mistake made is people don't understand that political parties consist of factions. And that if you don't understand the factional makeup of the party, you're going to make a lot of mistakes. Guess what? Presidents of the United States make these mistakes all the time. George Bush didn't get it about what was happening in his Republican Party on immigration. And so therefore, in 2007, when we thought, hey, look at this, we've got a Republican president, a new Democratic Congress, a Speaker of the House, all for immigration reform, it failed. Nor did Nancy Pelosi understand what was happening in her party on immigration and the absolute sort of non-interest of some very important parts of the Democratic base in immigration. So in looking at inside players, we have to look at factional politics. Outside players, the public. There are a lot of issues that the public doesn't have an opinion on. They really don't care. Okay? And yet, political actors try to pretend, sometimes through some little magic hocus pocus, they try to make you think that they have an opinion on it. This is the problem of non-attitudes out there. And so the role of outside players is very tricky. All of this files into an old-fashioned political science concept. E.E. Schatzschneider, some of you may recognize him, who wrote literally in when I was a toddler, was writing this, about the scope of conflict, right? What is the appropriate scope of conflicts? And the insight he has to change is the following. When you have conflict and you expand the conflict, you never know who's going to win. Every time you expand the conflict, you create a different dynamic. So if you can win something by going to the Ways and Means Committee and getting three phrases stuck into the tax bill, well, of course, that's the way you're going to win it. Okay? You don't go buy television advertising. You don't go to the big, broad public and do it. Sometimes, however, you have to keep expanding that scope of conflict because you can't win at the smaller level, and you've got to go big. Every time you go big, though, you don't know. Change, a lot of change has been thwarted by people not understanding the level at which they ought to play and the level at which they can win. And that's a particularly tricky, skilled thing. This is art. This is not science, as much as I tried to wrap it up in political science and make it look like it was. So those are sort of, that's kind of a construct here, and I'm going to put the construct on the table, and then in our discussion we can talk about your issues in terms of some of these constraints on change.
That is really interesting, especially the last point you made, which is maybe something that those of us who think we're fighting for democracy may have a sentimental attachment to, assuming that the broad public debate is the way to go at all times, which may or may not always be the case. Trey Grayson.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be with all of you. You do realize there's two Republicans on this panel. just checking, just make sure everybody knew that. I thought, when I was trying to figure out what to say today, I kind of asked myself the question, what can realistically be done in the short run? You know, what are some things that we can do? Maybe even on the third commenter, that maybe this would be a little bit of a segue to the final panel. And it's a couple of interesting insights. I mean, one, a lot of the stuff that's talked about today, Republicans either don't agree with or don't care much. Maybe there's not disagreement, but they don't care much. And since we're kind of in a two-party system, that's problematic. We've, on some of the earlier panels, talked about the lack of trust that a lot of people have. The IOP, the Institute of Politics that I run, we've been doing millennial surveys for the last 15 years. And what's been striking over the last couple of surveys is the declining trust levels. And interestingly, and this wouldn't be the same from 40 years ago, is the number one most trusted institution is the military. And everything else is pretty far below. And the closer the government gets to the individual, the higher level of trust, meaning they like local better than state and state better than federal. It's probably the right insight, but it's... And even the military number is pretty low. So there's, but that's not just a millennial fact. That's, we all don't trust things. And so one of the things when I was in office, we tried on a couple of different areas to, when we were making change, to try to get some small wins, to build some confidence, to build some trust. They seemed to be more achievable. And so I think the way to do that is to focus on the states. We've heard earlier today about some of the things that have been happening in some of the states, and we'll have a few more years to study the impact of some of the changes in California, some of the, you know, Washington State has a primary reform and some of these other things. But I think the states are a way, it's more manageable, it's easier to, I just think that's the right approach. I was the Secretary of State for about 7 years, and then for the last 6 months, I was with Bob and Ben on the Presidential Elections Commission. And I wanted to mention a couple of areas in election administration that I think are winnable and will not only make the democracy work better, will not only be more democratic, but will make our governance work better. Some of these are things that we came up with our commission, and one is actually one we didn't talk about, we weren't allowed to talk about. Yesterday, Bob and Ben talked about why the commission worked. I mean, we kind of narrowed our focus, narrowed our goals, where we could find agreement. And I think that was really helpful. And to me, the one thing, and I told this to the president when we met with him, the one thing that I think the folks in this room can do, the one issue that we could really get behind, which make a big difference, is the voter registration modernization. Thank you. it's one that cuts across party lines. And what do I mean by that? So one, you know, there's a couple of things that we generally mean by voter registration modernization. One is putting more of this information, or getting the processes more online, meaning you can update your registration online. You can actually register online. The reality is that we as a country are moving around a great deal, and being able to update some of this information online is better. It's more effective, and that'll create a more accurate list. I mean, we were challenged to think about lines, and one of the things we really realized is line was a symptom, and what were the underlying problems? And one of the biggest problems was messed up lists of voter registrations. People not on the list who should have been or in the wrong spot. And so if you can, using technology, get more of that online, more of this process is online, you get a better list. There's something called ERIC. I don't know if they talked about that yesterday, but ERIC is a project started by Pew, and it's now about 7 states, and it's growing. And the idea behind ERIC is to take existing lists, mash them up, but then also throw in other lists, like credit cards and driver's license, and find out not only who's registered in what state, but who should be registered, who actually lives there but isn't registered. And so that allows you to make a more accurate list, but it also allows you to reach out to those who aren't registered and say, hey, you're not on the list. Looks like you live here. Let's get you on the list. Expansion of that would, I think, be really helpful. And then if you have more of this data, if you have a better list, if you have a better connection, on election day, rather than having a big old paper roster, you can actually have on an iPad or a laptop, you can have the voter roll, and you can have the whole thing on there. And so if somebody's in the wrong spot, you can get them to the right spot. And you can get quicker data. You can also find out when people are actually voting. What time of day are the peaks and valleys, rather than do it anecdotally. So that voter registration modernization, I think, you can do this in the states. It started in Arizona under Republican rule. West Washington was another real leader. Colorado, John Husted, who most activists on the left, or not John, Colorado Secretary of State Scott Gessler, who most activists on the left hate, is in favor of all this. So this is something I think, because it improves access, accuracy, and it results actually in cost savings. That's a nice win. And so that's one that I think ought to be a real focus. The other one, and this is not a huge national problem, but Attorney General Holder mentioned it, I guess, 2 days ago, is the felony voting issue. It impacts a couple really big states, Florida and Virginia. It impacts my own state. And I do think there's some opportunities here across lines. In 2008, when I supported making it easier to get our felons enfranchised, it would take a constitutional amendment in Kentucky to make it automatic. I stood at a press conference with the governor and got some criticism privately from some Republicans. And what's interesting the last couple of years is Rand Paul has stood out in favor for this. And as a result, the amendment actually passed the Kentucky House this year. And so having Rand giving some political cover to this, again, this is only impacting a few states because most states do it automatically. But it's something, if you could fix this problem in Virginia and Florida and Kentucky and in Iowa, that's a nice win. It would re-enfranchise a whole lot of people. And given the drug problems and other problems that people have that are becoming felons, this is touching a lot more people. And some more people in Kentucky, I think people are realizing, wait a minute, I have friends and family who are felons and I want them to be able to vote and be part of society. This is kind of silly. And so that's another one I think that's out there. Maybe it's a little bit harder to win on than voter registration modernization, but it's out there. We have a lot of other great recommendations in our report. I think the other one I'd say is data. One of the things that we learned in election, the commission, was that there's not a lot of data on elections. And unfortunately, because it's hard to compare elections to elections because so many factors are different. Is it an incumbent president? Is it, you know, what's going on? But if we can get better data, and again, this maybe is more for the foundations and for activists, to get that data out there, as David talked about transparency, let's get the data out there, and that'll help us make better decisions as well. So why don't I stop there? But those are, I think, some things that could be winnable that kind of cut across party lines and would make a difference and maybe give people some confidence to do some other things.
Thank you, Trey. And two things. One is that a number of people have referenced ERIC in various talks, and I know there are people out there saying, do I know him? So for you to define that ERIC is not a he was very useful, I know. But it is also striking that the issue of voting, which in some respects has been the most divisive in partisan terms, may also be one where there are real lessons for how to achieve meaningful bipartisan change. So partly because both parties feel they have some skin in the game, but that's very interesting. Deepak, thank you very much.
Thanks, Michael. I wanted to pick up on Bob Bellucci's, I thought, very provocative comments last night about the intertwined crisis of concentrated wealth and power on the one hand in America and the democratic crisis on the other. And it seems to me that in thinking about the democracy crisis, there's a 5-letter word that needs to be introduced, and that word is class. So how does the democracy crisis look from the bottom of the economic order, and how is that different from how it looks to elites? So over the last few months, I've spent a lot of time with residents of manufactured housing parks across the country who are largely low-income and white working-class folks who are going through a seismic shift in their living conditions because of the way that industry is reshaping itself. Rent increases, everyone's a tea party until your rent gets increased.
And your rent is too damn high.
And what's been interesting to me about that experience is how much it actually aligns experientially with what you hear back in communities I'm more familiar with, low-income working class communities of color working on issues of mass incarceration or economic justice or immigration reform, in the sense of the just remarkable sense of disaffection, the sense in which people's voices don't count, that they are being trod upon by an elite class in America. It's more than, you know, I've been doing community organizing in one form or another for over 20 years. It's more than I've ever seen, and it's a more common strain than I've ever seen it. And so for those folks, the problems manifest in very concrete ways, right? They manifest in substantive problems in their lives about rent increases, about not enough money to pay the bills, and so forth. And to Michael's point earlier, I think this ferment doesn't connect naturally or easily to a set of democratic process reforms. So if you believe, as I do, that some of the democratic crisis will in fact require some kind of popular upsurge, that it's probably not amenable by itself to an elite-centered strategy, and that for some of the reasons yesterday, we're not on the cusp of a kind of middle-class reform movement like the Progressive Era. So if you believe that it will require some kind of popular upsurge, which is a premise, the question then becomes, I think, how one connects that sense of disconnection, disaffection, not being heard, which is widespread among working class and lower income people in the country, to democratic reform. So that was kind of the challenge Michael put to me, which I think is hard. But I came up with three paths that I think are at least worth considering. The first is to build on existing institutions and organizations with constituencies that share an interest in seeing certain kinds of reforms take place. The best example of this on the left side would be the Democracy Initiative, looking at money in politics and filibuster reform and voting rights, where environmentalists, organized labor, civil rights organizations have tried to knit together an agenda, seeing them as common. Now, whether something like that is possible on the right, on those or a different set of issues, is an interesting question. But that seems to me to be a promising path to pursue. A second path is to think about how these issues of democracy actually play in existing social movements that are active in America. So I was very struck in some of this manufactured housing work that we're doing by the fact that if you started with a conversation about money and politics, you would get nods, yeah, people own our government, whatever, but you wouldn't necessarily get action motivated out of that conversation. When people look at who owns these parks, who is raising the rents, who's not making the repairs, what their contributions are, et cetera, it's a totally different discussion. And we've actually had huge success in making that connection for people. Folks were bankrolling campaigns to change Social Security that would radically affect residents' lives. So the integration into economic justice, immigrant rights, work around mass incarceration, places where large numbers of people are in motion trying to make change, and not just kind of paid staff of advocacy organizations, but where there's a genuine sense of real social movement in the country. It seems to me there is a lot of opportunity to do that in a way that connects to people's experience and connects to action. The third and last idea I wanted to put on the table is maybe the most disruptive thing that could be done on these issues in the next decade, if we were to take the long view, would be a project to make the electorate in America look like America. So if we were to take on the project of saying that the electorate should be as young, as diverse, representative of the population, which it is radically not at the moment, what would that unleash in terms of changes in our politics? Some would argue maybe nothing. I think it would actually change a great deal. And we do actually know how to do this between changes in systems and structures around voting that make voting easier, changes that make democracy more accessible to people who don't have the franchise, and through integrated civic participation that's not just about the vote, but connects the vote to issues that matter to people in a year-round way. It is actually an achievable goal, I think, maybe by 2020, maybe further out, and I think it could be the most disruptive change we could actually accomplish. So I'll stop there. Those are just a few offerings of pathways that I see of how to connect this kind of anti-elite populist sentiment in the country to a democracy agenda.
Thank you. That is really thoughtful and helpful. I found all of these. And I heard some interesting and not necessarily expected commonalities or themes. Elaine talked about the importance of understanding terrain and choosing the right terrain for action. David talked about the necessity of leadership, but especially something we haven't heard that much about over the last day and a half, executive leadership as a driver for policy and change. Trey talked about, in addition to the substantive reforms, the importance of working in states where there are opportunities for change. And Deepak talked about the opportunities where social movements are already happening and where expanding the electorate and bring the electorate in, again, in the states is a key factor. And none of those are on the floor of the House or Senate as strategies. And as we grappled over the last few days with how to empower the leadership of Congress, it's quite striking how many of these other strategies take a somewhat different route. I want to see if any of you have any thoughts on what the others have said, and then I know that our participants and have questions and comments. We could start. Why don't we go to the audience and, you know, certainly, but don't stay in your lanes. Feel no obligation. Yeah. Spencer?
Thanks, Mark. I've enjoyed the conference. Spencer Overton. I'm a GW Law Professor and at the Joint Center. I was just going to say that I think that history is definitely important, and I don't mean to diminish history, but I also think that we can't go back. We've talked about strong parties, kind of some romantic notions of civic republicanism in terms of if we could just empower the elites. And I don't believe that kind of an overly simplistic descriptive notion of a democracy is definitely the way to go either. But I do think two big factors, and it's come up a bit, Tom Sines mentioned it, this notion of demographic fear, right, the diversification of America. I also think the increasing communities that we see that are created as a result of social media, right, are two big factors, so that when we talk about governability and pushing back, allowing folks to work together, I think that those are two key issues. And David, you know, focused on this notion of dealing with the problems of today and tomorrow, right, as opposed to this kind of binary piece where we're looking for solutions from the past to resuscitate, to deal, if we could just go back to how things were then. I just think that our answers, the practical answers, have to focus on the issues of today. And, you know, Trey pointed on this in terms of, you know, VRM as a practical a solution, right, that's tailored to opportunities that we have today that we didn't have in the past. So it's really much more a comment than a question and a summary of all the good content that I thought was here today. Thanks.
Well, to the extent that what we're in part, is a period of dislocation change and a mismatch between the current political institutions and the political forces or the problems. And we've heard this in a number of different ways. Even in the last panel, the idea that bipartisan redistricting panels assume that the two current parties are going to always be there forever. How does one make change or plot strategies for change in that unsettled environment that we all feel we live in?
Let me answer that by talking about something that actually we haven't talked about yet, which is the sequester. Okay, the sequester was a big, big deal, right? Mm-hmm. It was supposed to force everybody, oh my God, it was supposed to be a nuclear option, and it came and went with barely a whisper. Now, let's think about the sequester in this polarized time. The structure for the sequester was, in fact, the deal. It was the grand bargain, just that nobody sort of recognized it, because the structure for the sequester took all entitlements off the table. That's what the Democratic base cares about more than anything, is protecting Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. Took them off the table. And the other piece of the sequester meant that, okay, the axe was going to really fall on discretionary spending, and for all the complaints about, you know, youth programs being cut, what's really discretionary spending? It's military, okay? The military is the 800-pound gorilla of the discretionary U.S. budget. So everybody got what they wanted. Democrats looked at the sequester and said, oh, my God, we could actually cut defense spending without being accused of being soft on defense. And the Republicans learned, to their chagrin, that all these pain-in-the-you-know-what Tea Party guys, actually, one of the things they were most mad about was they were most mad about George Bush and his foreign policies and his taking us into wars all over the globe. They were perfectly happy, to the chagrin of, like, the John McCains and some of the more traditional Republicans. They were perfectly happy to, you know, chop off the head of the Defense Department. So you had in the sequester, you actually had a deal. You actually had a coming together of the two parties. But you couldn't see it because it didn't look like a deal. It didn't feel like a deal. Right? But in fact, it was a deal, which is why it still exists, guys. Okay? The discretionary cuts still exist in the sequester.
But let me just add a comment to that. And maybe I'm alone in the room in thinking this. But a deal that sacrifices America's ability to preserve peace and security on the planet in order to ensure that Medicare, as we know it, continues to overcharge the American customer, and to take 60% more to deliver the same results as everybody else gets, that doesn't strike me as a very good deal. That strikes me as the outline of a terrible deal. And it points to a problem that I have, which is that this deal-itis mania is a product of a political system where there aren't leadership. There isn't leadership. It does not happen in Germany. It doesn't happen in Britain. It doesn't happen in Canada. It doesn't happen just about anywhere, that when people who have who are the most visible, the best known, the most likely to be held to account by the electorate, when they decide to make choices to favor defense over health care, to favor health care over defense, that they have to pull 87 people into a room and get all of them to agree. What happens everywhere else is the party leaders of the people who happen to hold power, they make decisions. Everyone knows they've made the decisions and they're held to account and they can enforce the decision. The deal-itis is a symptom of the larger problem. And this, by the way, this is not how it worked in America even a generation ago. Once upon a time, I mean, America has always had more diffuse power centers than other democracies. But it was true that, you know, once the chairman and ranking member of the House Ways and Means Committee, and once their counterparts in the Senate, there are somewhat more of them in the Senate, agreed on something, they would work with the president and the Office of Management and Budget, and that was the budget. It was sloppier and messier and more wasteful than the comparable equivalent in other countries, but it was not as sloppy, as wasteful, as more out of control as it is today when you have to bring so many people into the room. I think we should be asking not the question, how do we make deals, but why do we need deals?
Well, there's a conflation that we've seen in some of the conversations about wanting to strengthen party leadership and wanting to strengthen parties. Parties are much stronger in American government than they have been, even as party leadership is less strong. And the role, as we said, of committees, which used to actually run the government, is almost vanished relative to these other things. Trey and Deepak, do you have, or we can bring in the... Marcia?
Yes, I'd like to get back to the role of the outside players, the public, the people, in engaging in the process, and about their understanding of the process. The sense I get is whenever there's the sausage making is on display, there's this pushback to that. So how can we get change and help the people to foster change when they have this visceral reaction to the process it makes to have change occur? And and also, if you can speak to the role of civic education and the impact it can have in that process.
I'll jump in on that. On the latter, on the civic education piece, and that's another one that there's pretty good agreement, at least the high level, on the need for more civic education. There's an agreement that there's less. And there's actually pretty good data on what you can actually do, that if we, I was on a commission that Circle put together last year, and we came up with some pretty good recommendations on, you know, if you actually engage people in conversations, they become more civically engaged. You know, if in schools, if we actually have discussions, those tend to result in more engaged citizens down the road. It's a long-term investment. And it's challenging with the STEM emphasis that we have in our schools, but I think it's an important one. And it is I actually wrote it as a kind of a secondary issue where maybe there is, we found bipartisan consensus in Kentucky to try to improve it at least at the margins. So I think that's the first, what was the first part of your question? I had a great answer in my head, it just escaped me, but what was your, remind me?
Well, the role, I mean,
role of the public.
You've actually faced an electorate.
I think one of the things, well, let me talk about it in the election sense. I always talk about how prior to 2000, nobody cared how we ran elections. And then all of a sudden we had a tie election, essentially, and we saw all the warts, and there were a lot of, and it was really embarrassing. And then since then, and this is, so I get elected in 03, and so I'm in office in 04, the first time we have a presidential election. And you could just see that the media and the public started to care a lot more and started demanding more for officials. I mean, it goes back to, I think Elaine earlier said, you got to talk about things that people actually care about or have an opinion. Nobody had opinion on elections. This last election, there was the line problem, and people started caring about that line problem. So it is, I think that's an example of, at least in the world of election reform, we've gotten a little bit more of the public's attention, and it's something that you can care a little bit about. I mean, the reality, though, if you look at polling, the number one issue is economy and jobs. And so I think if you're looking at broader structural reforms, you probably have to somehow tie those reforms to that issue to try to get the public to care a little bit about more. I mean, Mitch McConnell, you know, the guy who handpicked me to run for Senate, he always said nobody ever lost an election on a campaign finance reform. And he's probably right about that.
Hey, and he may not be there very much longer.
He will. If I had any money, which I don't, as a public, I would. There's no way he will lose.
Just to add to that, I think one of the dilemmas to this question is that the stuff happening in Washington, the rancor, the sense that, you know, we can't come to agreement on a long term plan on big problems, it's sort of the tip of the iceberg. It's not the iceberg. You know, so if you think about it compared to, say, Germany, there's significant labor unions, significant corporate interests that do sector bargaining about wages and working standards in whole industries. There's a kind of mediating institutions that underlie a social consensus. Those mediating institutions in this country have been under pretty relentless attack for 20 or 30 years. And so the Ted Kennedy who, you know, I learned so much from about how to do a principal deal. He'd call up five people and make a deal, right? Because they represented large numbers of people, and there were, you know, that ability is gone because mainline Protestant churches have vastly declining membership, labor unions vastly declining membership. So to me, part of it is, does that problem get fixed at the top of the iceberg, or does it get fixed in the country? With the building of organizations that are democratic, in which people can participate, make meaning of what's happening in politics, and take action together. That's a different road to travel than to think we can solve it at the top of the iceberg. I don't think we can.
So Walter Shapiro, I think John Fortier, and Meg Gage, am I right? That's, and then we will need to wrap up quickly, so we'll do it
okay,
all.
Okay, let me see if I can do this fast. I'm Walter Shapiro, a fellow here at the Brennan Center. Listening to this whole conference, I keep hearing in my mind the great phrase from the Republican economist Herb Stein, if something can't go on forever, it won't. And I feel that to some extent, some of the dysfunction we're talking about may be self-reforming. I'm also thinking about the period in the late 1970s when it was total orthodoxy at conferences like this that we will never have a two-term president again, that we've had one failed president after another, and something has changed in America. Then Ronald Reagan came along, and we've now had four two-term presidents. And what I wonder, watching, and I would like to get the reaction of the panel, watching the Republicans retreat on debt ceiling craziness, wondering, to some extent, watching big donors, wondering if Karl Rove didn't rip them off with Crossroads GPS in the 2012 campaign and other factors, whether many of these problems, not the big problems, but the level of out-of-control dysfunction will just go away on its own in the natural rhythms of American politics.
Okay. May I? Walter, there's an embedded syllogism in your comment. Since the American Republic must always be successful and powerful, and since the problems we're diagnosing impede the power and success of the American Republic, therefore those problems will go away. But to paraphrase Herb Stein's rule, this one that you assume that the thing that can't go on forever like this and therefore must stop are the American problems. They may be the American Republic. America's been so powerful and so strong for so long. It's hard for Americans to imagine a world in which that wouldn't be true. And yet the history of the world is full of failed commonwealths. Americans have an over-infatuation with the history of the Roman Republic. It's something that infuses our Republic. Although they sort of mix the Roman Republic and the Roman Empire together. But American intellectuals are always worried about the problems of how a republic can lose its republican character and then remain as powerful and wealthy as ever, but just simply lose its republican character. It's also, but there are other commonwealths, the Polish Commonwealth, where republican institutions fail and the country becomes a plaything for outside forces. I would just urge everyone not to ever take for granted American success. It doesn't have to be that way, and for all the other republics of history to date, it hasn't.
Thank you. John?
So John Fortier of the Bipartisan Policy Center. I want to ask a question of my former colleague at AEI, David Frum, and focus. I know you're interested in leadership and worried about the inability to make decisions But some of that is conditioned, as you noted, by the fact that we are a separation of power system and we don't have advantages of parliamentary systems. So I want to take that off the table and think about unifying of parties and party movements, and especially on the right, and take advantage of your knowledge of the world here. You see, I think, rises of populist conservative movements in the UK with UKIP and people's parties in European systems. Is there something to be learned from what is going on in the rest of the world about leaders, maybe not in separation of power systems, but leaders just trying to find unity in what has become a much more open system with stronger movements of populist conservatism that would be useful for us to learn here?
Thank you. We're both AEI alumni. I may answer your question, which is a very important one, a little simplistically, but I think conservative parties all over the world face a common crisis. First, their leaders are people who grew up in the 70s and 80s and learned their ideas in the 70s and 80s from the Reagan experience, from the Thatcher experience, and similar experiences in Britain and Germany. And they were people who were formed by the struggle against inflation, against social welfare spending that was in those days very rapidly rising, and against capitalist systems that seemed to be breaking down under the demands of claimants. And the core premise of all of the people who learned their politics in those years, is that in a right-left struggle, the story of the 70s and 80s was that the middle class, I mean, this is really simple-minded, but broadly, during the social democratic era from the 1930s to after the World War II, the middle class in these countries saw its interests as broadly aligning with those of people below them. And you had a period of left of center ascendancy. And in the crisis, the economic crisis of the 70s, they rethought that middle classes aligned with the interests of the people above them. And you had a period of center right hegemony. That may be ceasing to be true, that the interests of the middle and the interests of the top align. And people at the top are not making concessions. And there's no impetus at the top to rethink and to make a better deal for the people in the middle. And parties of the right are then caught in this bind. And the bind takes two forms. On the one hand, economic leadership insists on continuing economic policies that hugely advantage the people at the top and that are not so good for people at the middle. At the same time, as the people at the top insist on continuing and accelerating a process of immigration and ethnic change from which the people at the top clearly benefit and which people at the middle find both economically and culturally threatening. And so one of my stock messages to center-right parties is you can have middle-class economic stress. You can have rapid ethnic transition, but it's very dangerous when you have both at the same time.
Deepak, what are your thoughts on that and on both on the class issues and on the role of political parties as a vehicle for change for the people at the bottom?
One of the more notable things, I think, about our political moment, I really agree with that. It feels like the elite has in some ways seceded from the rest of the country and sort of lives in a completely different bubble with a totally different frame of reference, and it is actually dangerous, I think. And I'm actually shocked at the level of ignorance about the fact, about the sense of dislocation that working class people live with in this country, how far it is in a meaningful way from the political dialogue, how the drivers to more and more inequality persist. And so I think there is and you can see the strands of it emerging in fast food workers walking off the job, and the city of Seattle considering a $15 an hour minimum wage, the highest in the country. You can see the strands of a kind of populist revolt brewing in the country, which I think could have very positive pro-small-d democratic consequences. But it remains surprising to me that there is not any kind of elite effort to even smooth out the edges of a brutal economy and its consequences for people. It is self-defeating and a major failure of our political system. It's a little bit, I think, the reaping the rewards of 1970s decisions, but I think the consequences are going to be very harsh in our politics for some time to come in terms of the level of anger and polarization reflects real struggles that people are having in their lives, and it's volatile, and I think it's going to continue for a while.
Meg?
Meg Gage, Proteus Fund. I want to invite a conversation sometime down the road that draws a sharper distinction between bipartisan and nonpartisan, picking up some of what Keisha said and actually what Deepak said, particularly in light of the increasing concentration of wealth in the hands of fewer and fewer people, a conversation about democracy reform that tries to find the middle place between the Republicans and the Democrats seems to me unlikely to go anywhere. The primary goal of a political party is to win elections. And if your place of conversation is between where Republicans and Democrats can agree, you find yourself in this morally bankrupt position, in my opinion, where you can't support, for example, voting rights or immigration reform because that would help one of the parties. And I think, thinking of the next session, foundations and donors actually have a huge opportunity to broaden and illuminate that transpartisan space in ways that could really sort of hold up what does reform really mean. Particularly when the threats are coming from the concentration of wealth tied with great political power in a partisan framework, I don't see how we reach real reform if the conversation takes place between those two poles.
Thank you. Folks can comment, or Mark, does your question or comment, Mark, follow on that, or do any of the panelists want to speak to what Meg? Mark Schmidt?
Yeah. Mark Schmidt. I guess I want to maybe close out a little bit by draw. I mean, there have been threads of this discussion through the last 2 days, and not just, we didn't save it all for your panel, unfortunately, the question of how to get things done politically. And I feel like it's kind of flipped and flopped between two very distinct models of change. One being a kind of elite bargaining model. You need a bipartisan agreement model. That's what Bob and Ben talked about. It was, a lot of some of the discussion earlier yesterday. And the other being you need a mobilized base to get things done. That's obviously what Deepak's been talking about here. It's what Larry Cohen talked about from the Democracy Initiative. But I think people often preface those things by saying, the only way to get things done is my model. The fact is, yes, each of those models has many failures, and each of those models also has successes. There are times when we do get things done by bipartisan elite bargaining, as Elaine said. Those are examples of, keeping the scope of conflict relatively small. It feels to me like in the space of most democracy reforms, with possibly the exception of some of the election reforms, the problem is either one excludes the possibility of the other and creates a problem. A big base mobilization like the Democracy Initiative makes some of the issues around political reform more partisan and thus even more difficult to get to the ultimate place you want to be, whereas starting in the elite place makes it impossible to have enough pressure to get anything done. And I guess I wonder if there are ways that we could think about something where those two work hand in hand. I mean, where possibly some of the progress that has been made towards immigration reform is an example of where base moves elites or something like that. Or another alternative that I'm always interested in is, David had mentioned the deficit focus. It seems to me that for a long time, what led to the bargain that turned into sequestration, there was a sense that kind of got created that whatever you thought about how to get there, there was a unified sense that the deficit or the long-term fiscal picture was a problem that needed to be solved. So everybody kind of got pulled to that space. I know plenty of people would disagree with that, but it had a kind of consensus power that pushed people. And I just wonder where you think there are opportunities to bridge these two models of change.
Mark, I think
let's all comment on that.
Mark, I think you omitted a third and what has historically been usually the most important driver of change in states, and that is the perception of external threat. The foundation of the welfare state in Britain is often attributed to the shock of discovering the terrible quality of the troops that were recruited for the Boer War. The governments that had to, this was the largest mobilization, we remember it now as a small war compared to what came later, but it was the largest infantry mobilization the British state had ever done. And they were shocked at how the terrible, wretched physical condition of the people they were recruiting. And that led to the reforms that, between 1906 and 1910, the first unemployment insurance concerned with nutrition. In the United States, that the dramatic changes that took place in this country, so much of the response to the racial crisis has to be cannot be understood apart from Cold War competition, education reforms, the creation of the high school as we know it.
Highways.
These were responses to external threat. And we're all glad the Cold War is over, but I don't think it's totally coincidental that the era of peak sloppiness of the American state has coincided with the end of the Cold War. And it's how you can get decisions like, let's leave Medicare exactly as it is while massively cutting the defense budget, because the American state doesn't feel threatened. And it's why we can be so indifferent to the disaffection, the serious disaffection of your country at home. That when you are confronting external threats, you need a higher degree of social consensus, and that means you need to make sure that more people feel that they're participating in systems that are basically more or less fair. So the absence of that perception, I think, is one of the most profound shapers of the way our politics works. And what I worry about is somebody who's very concerned about state-to-state competition, is that when that competition reasserts itself, as it always does through the history of humanity, that the American state will be seriously unready.
Others?
I mean, I just say there's a reason why I talked about election administration, because I agree with the conflict between the two, and I thought I could. So it is, it's a big conflict.
Well, I just finished reading Ira Katznelson's book about the New Deal and the aftermath of it, and it really included all of the forces, external threat, social movements at some scale, workers' movements and others, and an elite that in a way was so shocked that portions of it began to be open to radically different ways of rearranging. I think the question that is a mystery in this moment is whether there is a portion of the American elite, leaving party aside, that's willing and able to reckon in a serious way with the level of dangers that the country faces. And I don't know the answer. I'm not sure we're there yet.
And the one last thing I would add, which takes off on the substantive point that Trey made, one way to think about expanding the role of the people at all levels in this, given that disaffection between the elite of the elite and the rest of the country in grappling with some of these things, are changes that create the space for more change. And that's where modernizing the voter registration system and other things that actually bring more voters in may make it easier to unstick some of the jams that are currently in the American political process in a way that one might not necessarily expect. But if you suddenly have more people to appeal to and different people, you could get potentially different outcomes. So we want to thank the panel.
Thank you. Thanks. And